Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On July 29th, a Tuesday, welcome, welcome, welcome to the show. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
So we have a very serious topic today. Recent images of children starving in Gaza have sparked international outrage. And for the first time, public disagreement between President Donald Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. America has long been Israel's closest ally, giving more military and financial aid than any other nation. But with new reports of a possible famine unfolding in Gaza, there are signs that U.S. support may be shifting. And one of those signs is a newly released Gallup survey that shows just 32% of U.S. adults now approve of Israel's military action in Gaza. It's a record low since the conflict began. And so today we will explore what's really happening in Gaza and how Americans are feeling about it. We'll also discuss what the U.S. role should be in this conflict and beyond. We have two different perspectives that we'll bring in on the show. And we also invite you, our listeners at home and elsewhere, to join in the conversation. Our questions of the day are this: what do you think America's role should be in the Middle East? And has your view changed in the past 2 years? You can call 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, you can put those comments in the live chat.
I'll repeat, what do you think America's role should be in the Middle East? And has your view changed over the past 2 years? Again, that number, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org.
Our trio of news stories, Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
Start with some local news here. Yes. The first story, this is an interesting one from The Inquirer, and it's about a supercomputer called Betty.
Ooh.
Betty was built by the University of Pennsylvania. It is expected to rate as one of the world's most powerful supercomputers. Penn built the supercomputer because its researchers, they say, need access to massive computing power, especially when it comes to research aided by AI. And here's an interesting twist. Betty was not built at Penn's West Philly campus. It was built 30 miles away in Montgomery County, and that's because Betty requires way more power than Philly's grid could provide in a cost-efficient manner. Betty burns enough electrical power to power 1,000 homes and is louder than a commercial jet. I thought this was a fascinating story, Cherry.
Yeah, and that's loud. Visitors apparently have to wear earplugs when they walk through the data center there. And Betty apparently quadruples the university's computing capacity with plenty of room to grow. And what was so interesting about this story to me is the need for all this power. I mean, it has already started driving up our electric bills across the country. I mean, on average, the electric bills in the U.S. have gone up about 4.5% in the last year. And New Jersey saw a 20% rise in electricity costs between 2017 and 2025. Delaware, 42% increase during that period. And Pennsylvania saw a 53% increase between 2017 and 2025. Now, I'll say that according to CBS, the data centers were a big part of it, but there were other factors as well. But those data centers will drive up, you know, they require so much power, it could impact us all.
Not to mention the impact on the climate.
Yes, absolutely.
Which is a huge consideration. One thing that I thought was really interesting in this story is that this project, the timeline for approving this project was really quick,
really
condensed. That's according to The Inquirer. Typically, you know, starting a new big, expensive research initiative takes some time and planning, blah, blah, blah. They were itching to get this done. And I think that's because there is this there's this arms race in the AI world. And so that's going to conflict with local communities, both the price of their electricity. They're going to be concerned about that, but also just the impact of building all these data centers. And we're hoping to do a show about this in the not too distant future.
Yeah, because Pennsylvania is trying to be a leader when it comes to these data centers. So how will that impact the bottom line here? Yeah. That's going to be interesting. Second story.
New Jersey.
Yes. A new poll in the New Jersey governor's race shows Democratic nominee Mikey Sherrill ahead of Republican nominee Jack Cittarelli by 8 points. This is a Fairleigh Dickinson University poll. Of about 800 likely voters, 45% said they're voting for Cheryl, 37% chose Cittarelli, but 16% said that they are undecided. A Rutgers Eagleton poll taken early this month gave Cheryl a 20-point lead.
Whoa.
And, you know, and New Jersey, people forget, New Jersey has more Democrats than Republicans, although the number of Republicans has been growing over the past few years. But according to the poll's director, Cittarelli will have to sway independents his way. He'll have to also peel off some Democrats if he wants to win. And that he's done really well among independents when he focuses on local issues. Of course, Cheryl wants him to be glued to Trump.
Right.
Which turns people off.
Yeah, I think if you are a Republican and you're looking at the big races this November, there aren't that many of them. There's a governor's race in Virginia and there's one in New Jersey. I think the New Jersey one is the one you hope to be the closest. Mm-hmm. These are both blue-leaning states. But it's because of the facts on the ground. New Jersey, the Republican is well known, running again, actually probably has as much or more name recognition than the Democrat. Two, New Jersey is the state that has swung reddest in the more recent elections. So there's more momentum there. If these polls hold and that gap remains, I think it's a pretty bad sign for the political climate right now for Republicans. Doesn't mean it will hold till the midterms in 2026. But if you're going to pick one of these races to be close, to give you hope as a Republican that maybe there isn't a Trump backlash, New Jersey's, in my opinion, the one you want to look at. And these are not great early numbers for Republicans.
No.
But they're early.
Yeah. And by the way, I mean, like the poll said, 16% were undecided. And so, you know, Mikey Sherrill has, you know, to shore up her her Democratic base. And by the way, I have to mention that she's already announced her pick for lieutenant governor. It's Dale Caldwell. He's African-American, president of a small university in Warren County. He's a pastor of a Methodist church in Plainfield and a former New Brunswick school board member. So he's very well known throughout the state.
And Jack Cittarelli, by the way, has picked Sheriff Jim Gannon, who's up from Morris County, North Jersey guy. So third story, Cherry.
Yeah.
This one has been bubbling under the surface for a while.
I was actually surprised when you brought this up. I was like, what? Didn't even know about it. Go ahead.
You had to be a little bit in the know. There were some tea leaves out there, but it's starting to become more known. There is more and more evidence that the Eagles want to build a new stadium that would open in approximately 2032.
What?
The team recently sent a survey to season ticket holders that mentioned this possibility of a new stadium. Philly Voice also reported the team convened focus groups of season ticket holders and basically stated in these groups that they're aiming for a new stadium. The Eagles' current home, Lincoln Financial Field,
is nice, but hey,
opened 22 years ago. There's also rumors that this new stadium, if it happens, we'll caveat everything here, if it happens, might be a domed stadium. Eagles owner Jeffrey Lurie was asked about those rumors in February, said he was torn about the idea, but did not exactly shoot them down. So possibly a new Eagle stadium in 2032 and possibly a domed stadium in South Philly. Pretty interesting.
I'm going to, you know, roll my eyes. Okay, like a 12-year-old right now, because I'm like, dome shloom. I mean, these teams are such prima donnas. I mean, yes, they are Super Bowl winners. Go Birds. I'm not hating on my Eagles. But a stadium can technically last up to 50 years. And it's only at 22, and they're already talking about a new one.
Technically, I think it could last way longer.
Yeah, way longer.
That.
And I mean,
there's old stadiums.
I mean, and it's just, you know, it's like, why do we need a new stadium every couple of decades? It just seems like it's very expensive. And, you know, and I get it.
The answer is because they can't.
And it just seems like
the answer is because the money is rolling in. We don't know if there'll be public backing for this, taxpayer backing for this, but that's always a possibility. It's on the table. The answer is because they can, and they can charge a lot for seats.
But then no one's going to be able to afford it. We're all going to be stuck in the parking lot tailgating because the tickets are going to be so expensive.
I would say this. I think Jeff Lurie, who owns the Eagles, has been a really good owner, and he's really changed the trajectory of the whole franchise.
It's a great team and the franchise, yes.
However,
mm-hmm.
if I were advising him, Jeff, I would say tread carefully on this one. Mm-hmm. I do not think fans are going to want a dome stadium. They are very much attached to the idea of those outdoor games late in the year, the tradition wrapped into all of that. We are very tradition-bound folks here. in Philadelphia.
We like what we like.
Especially in the sports world. So, yeah, I would tread lightly on this one. It might still happen. It might still happen. But I do think there will be backlash, especially if they want to build a dome.
And by the way, the link is nice.
But they have,
it can have upgrades.
But
you
here's
can
the
upgrade.
Deal. Here's the deal.
I'm not against upgrades.
They've got a lot of goodwill right now.
Yeah.
And what do you do with goodwill? You cash it in.
Cash. Cha-ching. All right.
Maybe
all
literally.
Right.
All right. Well, we're going to come back on the other side of this break. We're going to talk about America's role in the Middle East, the ongoing crisis in Gaza. We want to hear from you. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org or drop a comment in the live chat on YouTube.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Each day seems to bring a new grim assessment of the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. This morning, a UN-backed organization called the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification issued an interim report. And in it, the group said the worst case scenario of famine is currently playing out in the Gaza Strip.
All of this comes in the wake of a U.S.-backed nonprofit, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, taking control of food and aid distribution in the blockaded territory. The GHF is merely one example of America's deep involvement in this conflict and region, an involvement that spans decades.
And it's a role that Americans seem to regard with growing skepticism, if not outright hostility. At least that's what public polling indicates. Today, we discussed America's long support of Israel, its diplomatic position in the Middle East, and whether a major change is in order.
We have a pair of guests this hour. First, we're going to welcome Hussein Ibish, senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. Hussein, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
It's great to have you. And for our listeners at home, what do you think America's role should be in the Middle East? Has your view changed over the past 2 years? Call 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube, drop a comment in the chat.
And I want to read this comment on YouTube from John, who says, "While I have believed strongly in the past in strong support for Israel, the move from oppressed population to oppressing occupier makes me believe we must scale back." And so, Hussein, I wanted to start with you because, you know, the UN aid agencies and journalists have said that famine is unfolding in Gaza, that children have reportedly died from hunger or dehydration. Can you tell us what is going on there?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think your caller, the comment that you read is indicative of a certain shift, but we'll get to that. Yeah, what's happening in Gaza is a man-made famine. Israel had been greatly restricting humanitarian supplies into Gaza from the beginning of the war caused by Hamas's attack against southern Israel on October 7, 2023. But until March 18 of this year, humanitarian groups, the UN and others, were able to operate in Gaza and keep a famine at bay. There were about 400 aid distribution centers and there was hunger and food insecurity, but no real famine. Now, since October 18, when Israel broke the ceasefire with Hamas and imposed a total blockade on Gaza, there has been the growth of a man-made famine because of Israel's restriction on aid. The only aid it allows is through the group you mentioned, the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which operates four aid distribution hubs at which over 1,000 Palestinians have been shot dead while approaching either at the wrong time or in the wrong way. And Israeli troops have been quoted in Israeli media as saying they just use live fire as crowd control. They don't, use any other means. So if Palestinians approach in what the Israelis consider the wrong time or place, they just get shot down. And that's why 1,000 have died. And meanwhile, now you've got real starvation. Over 115 cases, cataloged in the past few days. About 80 of them children, because children are very susceptible to this. And it's dire.
You alluded to that report in Haaretz, which is an Israeli outlet. One soldier said, quote, "It's a killing field where I was stationed. Between 1 and 5 people were killed every day. They are treated like a hostile force. No crowd control measures, no tear gas, just live fire with everything imaginable. Our form of communication is gunfire." So what is the possible, what is
fact,
the possible
justification?
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, what's the justification for that? Well, there isn't any, but let me just add that the total of 1,000 deaths reinforces that account. In other words, the description from the Israeli troops about how they're told to act, and the total number of Palestinians who've been killed since May 26 reinforce each other. They make total sense put together. When you put them against the denials of the Israeli military or others, that doesn't make sense. What could justify this? Well, the Israelis say that they can't trust the UN and international aid agencies. They don't trust them for a variety of reasons. They're infiltrated with terrorists, or they're too pro-Palestinian, or Hamas steals the aid, which the aid groups in the UN deny. But it's systematically, no one's saying that hasn't happened. Of course it's happened. But then, you know, recently the Israelis turned to airdrops of just sort of bundles of aid into the middle of fields in Gaza. Now, if you're worried about Hamas or people with guns seizing the aid, that's the perfect way to make sure that happens, right? Because you're just throwing the aid into a field. And obviously
you're saying there's an internal contradiction in their logic. And their justification.
Profound.
So I just want to, I guess, talk about some reaction to this, some recent developments. Some of it is reaction directly to this, some of it not. And I want you to say if any of this you think is actually meaningful in the big picture. One is France stating it will recognize Palestinian statehood, and more recent reporting that the UK is very quickly moving in that direction. The other is the reports from international agencies, UN-backed agencies, that there is indeed famine and starvation. The third is two Israeli rights groups stating that they believe there is a genocide happening in Gaza. Of those three, do any of those three, do you think, really matter, big picture, could actually change, could put pressure on the Israelis to change their position here? And if so, which of the three?
Well, I think they all matter, actually, but in different ways. I think you have to separate the first, which is the question of European states that have been very friendly to Israel historically recognizing a state of Palestine, as opposed to the growing recognition of the famine in Gaza, the man-made famine in Gaza, and also groups like B'Tselem in Israel, which can hardly be described as anti-Israeli, because they are Jewish Israeli groups, accusing their own government of a genocide in Gaza. So it's not just South Africa or groups that have been traditionally hypercritical of Israel, but actually Jewish Israeli groups that are on the left, but still have never used language like this in the past or anything like it. So first of all, I do think the B'Tselem recognition of that Israeli policy is genocidal and constitutes a genocide in Gaza is really important, because it makes it much harder to characterize others who say that as just anti-Semitic or hysterically anti-Israel. The famine itself has forced the Israelis to open corridors in the past 24 hours and use airdrops and other means to expand humanitarian aid. So while the situation is getting worse, the Israelis are starting to shift. And I think they know that the onus will be entirely on them if thousands of people start dropping dead from starvation, and they can't afford that. Finally, when it comes to the recognition of Palestine, I think that's actually a little different.
Okay. How so?
I think that's as much a reaction to the war in Gaza as it is to what's been happening in parallel that most people haven't been following, but these governments have in the occupied West Bank, where 40,000 Palestinians have been displaced in the north, and where the Israeli right, including inside the government, has been moving carefully towards potential annexation of a large chunk of it or all of it during the Trump administration. The annexationist wing in Israel has been very excited about the election of Trump, and they have concluded that the next 3 years is the time to do it. And the way to do it is to create a violent situation. And the international community that remains committed to peace, which really can only be based on two states, since these people are not, I think, ready to live together in a single state. They each need a state, and they both need self-determination in some way or another. So some version of a two-state solution is a must, but it can't survive Israel swallowing up 40 or 50 or more percent of the occupied West Bank. And I think that's the message that the French and possibly the British, the Portuguese, the Greeks and others are likely to start sending to the Israelis.
Yeah, I want to bring in a caller. We have Gary from Mount Airy on the line. Gary, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
It's mostly a comment. I'm a anti-Zionist Jew, and I just want to say that all Jews around the world have always said since the Nazi genocide, never again. So it's rather unbelievable that our people who originated that slogan and been the victim of the worst genocide in history would be the perpetrators themselves. And it just shows how an entire nation can be brainwashed to become totally psychopathic murderers. Of course, we've seen how a third of our nation has been brainwashed. The other thing is that genocide is not some shibboleth or some exaggeration. One of the key definitions of genocide requires motivation, intention. And the leaders, the defense and security leaders of Palestine, have been quoted and on camera as saying that the Palestinians are animals. They deserve all to
Yeah.
be
And I think you
killed.
mean leaders of Israel and the politicians in Israel. Thank you so much, Gary.
That's Gary
He's
from Mount
quite right.
Airy.
I wanted to just read in another comment here and get your response to this,
Sure.
Hussein. Yunetta says the U.S. uses Israel as a proxy for its interests in the Middle East. The fig leaf of protecting Jewish people is undermined by domestic policy that allows anti-Semitism to flourish in the right wing. The only reason why other countries have not been able to step in to curb Israel's atrocities is because the U.S. provided nuclear weapons and uses its UN Security Council veto to shield them. Let's actually just use that as a springboard to talk about what the U.S. role you believe should be moving forward. I mean, because I think that is what
That's a
we're
great
debating in this
question.
country.
No, I really appreciate that. Look, let me just a little correction. It wasn't the US that
I think
facilitated
if
the
France was
Israeli
deeply
nuclear
involved
bomb.
in that,
Yeah, it
right?
was France. It was France.
That's a
So
good correction.
the
Thank you.
French move. Yeah, no, it's really important because France was the main guarantor of Israel's security between 48 when it was corrected and 1967 when the US basically took over. But that makes it all the more resonant. Look, I think the U.S. needs to be more balanced. There's no doubt about it. The U.S. has not has done has been insufficiently committed to two things. Number one, pressuring the Israelis not to take steps on the ground that make a two-state solution impossible. It's not just annexation in theory, it's also de facto annexation through settlement building, grabbing land and filling it up with Jewish Israelis who are then surrounded by armed people, and you're just gobbling up the land piece by piece rather than wholesale. Both are disastrous in the long run because they build up. The second thing is you do need reform among Palestinians. The PA is not a well-functioning institution. It was only set up for a five-year transition to Palestinian independence in the occupied territories. That didn't happen, so the PA has kind of limped along as this kind
of... And just to clarify for our listeners, that is the group that has political control in the West Bank, not in Gaza.
In small self-ruled areas of the West Bank, where we're in the Palestinian cities, mostly in the West Bank. It's controlled by Fatah, which is still the dominant political party among Palestinians. It wants a negotiated peace with Israel, but it hasn't gotten anywhere as Israeli society has moved more and more towards annexation rather than an agreement. So they've been sitting there looking pretty helpless, but they need reform. They need to rebuild civil society. They need themselves to become more inclusive. So you need pressure on both sides and benchmarks also. I think people say, oh, we tried benchmarks with the Palestinians. It really never happened. But there were steps that were outlined they should take, but it was never linked to specific rewards. And so that's really the way we could do it, is by saying to the Palestinian Authority and the PLO, if you do X, Y, and Z reforms, you get A, B, and C political rewards. And Israel gets security guarantees, and everybody gets what they need. As long as the two people are willing to live in two states alongside each other, this can work. Now, right now, if you poll the people on the ground, they don't respond very well to that idea. But that's because they've been convinced, both in theory and in practice, over the past 30 years or so, that the other side doesn't want that, and the only language they understand is force, and they're all genocidal.
Why should the U.S. play the convening role in that? Because I would imagine at this point, there is a great deal of mistrust for the U.S., maybe even on both sides of this, actually, although I'd imagine especially on the Palestinian side. Why would they agree to allow the U.S. to be the convening force here? And if they're not, who steps into that power vacuum? Is it the Gulf states? Is it really someone else? Yeah.
Yeah, it's really the second part that's the problem. I mean, it's not like the U.S. is beating off all kind of other eager contenders. Yeah. I mean, French kind of do want to be a broker, but that's about it. And France themselves, while they are surely the most important European country and most powerful, they don't really have the authority, the gravitas, the position in the Middle East to guarantee a kind of a settlement. The United States has. Why should the U.S. do this? Well, because, first of all, we alone can deliver the Israelis. Like they won't listen to any other country other than the United States. Often they don't listen to us, but we're the only ones they might even possibly listen to. The second thing is we have a military footprint in the Middle East, in the Gulf, in the Eastern Mediterranean, in Greece and Turkey, in the Red Sea, that gives us the potential to really be a security guarantor in a way that no other country would. And finally, we've spent decades beating off everybody else and refusing to allow anyone else to really get involved except to back up our efforts. So we've also sort of narrowed the field ourselves, and now to walk away from it would be, I think, a little hypocritical.
I want to read this. This is just in from the New York Times, which reports that Prime Minister Keir Starmer announced today that Britain would recognize the state of Palestine in September if Israel does not agree to a ceasefire with Hamas. And by the way, Henry has commented, Stop arming Israel. Let them stand on their own. Feed Gaza. And Hussein, I wanted to just bring up a recent poll that came out today from Gallup. It shows that just 32% of U.S. adults now approve of Israel's military action in Gaza. It's a record low since the conflict began. And disapproval has hit around 60% with only 8% of Democrats supporting the military effort. And I want to talk about what this change in American sentiment could mean as far as, you know, American participation in this effort.
Well, Sherry, it could mean a lot because the one thing that's been missing, you know, since the end of the Cold War until now, in getting the parties to any kind of working arrangement or even functional negotiations is U.S. pressure on Israel. U.S. has been very willing to pressure the Palestinians. There are two maybe historical incidents where the U.S. has pressured Israel to get them to come to the negotiating table, but to actually change their policies, Not really. So it's been very weak stuff. And we really haven't had a Palestinian policy, just a policy towards the Palestinians that's always refracted through our relationship with Israel. So we certainly need to develop a policy towards the Palestinians that's independent, that's bilateral. And then we need to develop the ability to pressure the Israelis. Now, what's fascinating is that most Jewish Americans are Democrats and liberals. And so when you see support for the Gaza war tanking among Democrats, that means it's tanking among most Jewish Americans too. And I think Gary gave us a real indication of how many Jewish Americans feel alienated from this conduct.
And I want to bring in another caller now. This is Mark from Philadelphia on the line who has a comment and maybe can speak to that as well. Mark, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Awesome. I just want to make a great comment specifically for NPR, because I've been listening to you guys for years, and you were the first news outlet that really covered this from the moment that, well, when Netanyahu got kicked out of office and then when he came back in. But the purpose, the biggest thing I want to talk about is how you guys covered them about him expanding the territories, which other news networks did not carry. I did not talk about a lot. And I think the most frustrating for me is that, like, as a proud tax-paying American who graduated from Cheltenham High School, which Netanyahu graduated from, so I've been following this since I was in middle school, and just knowing from a young age that it was wrong, and that on top of everything else, as a taxpayer, that my tax dollars are actually paying for this.
Thank you so much. So Mark kind of saying, right, that there that there this pressure through expansion, specifically, I think, into the West Bank is what he's referring to, has really been an important turn pivot point. Go ahead, Sherry.
Yeah, and I also wanted to follow up with you, Hussein, because Prime Minister Netanyahu is viewed unfavorably by 52% of Americans, the worst rating of his career. And then I wanted to play this clip from President Donald Trump, because he recently there's a public dispute between the Prime Minister and the President. Take a listen to the President's comments.
We're going to be getting some good, strong food. We can save a lot of people. I mean, some of those kids are, that's real starvation stuff. I see it. And you can't fake that. So we're going to be even more involved.
And you hear this mounting pressure because the prime minister has said there is no starvation going on. The president, our president, is acknowledging the starvation. What do you think that conversation will be like? Because I'm just thinking this is an opportunity where you have a Republican president. You already have, you know, disapproval on, you know, mass disapproval by Democrats. Now, as the pressure sort of mounts, what is the next step?
Yeah, it's really interesting because Netanyahu and Trump really don't like each other personally at all. And it goes back to the real breaking point was in 2020 when Biden defeated Trump, and Netanyahu put off publicly congratulating Biden to the last possible second, but then he did it.
Yeah.
And Trump was infuriated. He said, look at everything I did for you guys and for you. And you congratulated Biden, who cheated, and all this delusions about 2020. He never really forgave Netanyahu for that. And then ever since, there's been this weird relationship where they need each other politically, and they are joined at the hip politically. But personally, they don't like each other at all. So there's that. The second thing is that I do think there's growing pressure on the United States to do something, because it's not just Israel that's going to be held responsible for mass starvation in Gaza, which is starting. And if it doesn't stop immediately, that's going to be on them criminally as well as in all other ways. It will also be on the United States, because the Biden administration and then the Trump administration has backed up the Israelis in Gaza to a very large extent. The only real hiccup in that was the Biden administration withheld some heavy weaponry re-ups that were really more about Lebanon than the West Bank.
So that brings me to my question, though, Hussein, which is, what does pressure from America actually look like in practice? Because I think the American public might shift on this. That could put some political pressure on leaders. But then that political pressure has to translate to some sort of policy shift. And it is hard to envision what that looks like, because all we know, mostly as Americans, is a mostly unconditional support for the state of Israel. We really can't envision something else. So
it's
help us envision
change.
It. What does it look like?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It's a paradigm shift, right? We'd have to imagine a new reality. It's been since the late 70s that the or the early 80s that the special relationship in quotes has been no longer debated, and it's becoming a live issue again for the first time in many decades. What would it look like? Well, at the most extreme, it would involve withholding weapons, which is what we do usually with our allies, like the Saudis, that happened to them regarding the Yemen war, or other countries that which we arm. We at a certain point to really express our dissatisfaction, we say, no, you can't have those missiles or those airplanes or what have you. But there's a lot that could come before that. It could be a reduction of the knee-jerk defense of Israel at the United Nations and in other international forums, where we have their back in a big way. And often it's the votes are everybody versus Israel, like Micronesia and a few small countries that they give aid to, and the United States versus everybody else. And we could change that. We could start abstaining, and we could start voting no. And finally, we could be more critical of them and begin exploring our own alternatives, looking at Israeli policy as a more part of a more holistic Middle East policy, connected not just to the Palestinians, but to Saudi Arabia, to Iran, to all these questions. And I think that would lead to a more balanced approach.
Well, thank you so much. That's Hussein Ibish, senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. Hussein, thanks so much for your time today.
Guys, I really appreciate it. Thank you.
And coming up next, we're going to get the perspective of a columnist living in Jerusalem. So keep those comments and questions coming. 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We've been talking about the humanitarian crisis in Gaza, if it could lead to a change in America's longstanding relationship with Israel.
And we are now turning to a view from Israel. What does public opinion look like there? We have Mati Friedman, who's joining us now. He's an author and Jerusalem-based columnist for the Free Press. Mati, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're glad to have you. We also want to hear from our listeners and viewers. What do you think America's role should be in the Middle East? Has your view changed over the past 2 years? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube, drop a comment in the live chat.
Before we bring in Mati, we want to bring in this caller. We have Ina from Philadelphia who's on the line. Ina, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
I have been often disturbed by the one-sided view that rarely takes into account the reason for Israel's the necessity for a very defensive and, of course, lately offensive approach. Yes, I have visited Israel for. Since the 1960s, and never have I gone there when there hasn't been an attack before or after or within within a short period of time. That only after 9/11 can we Americans understand what it means to be searched and check for bombs and look for packages that are unattended. And this has been going on in Israel's entire history. So I understand why there is a certain degree of defensiveness and the need to always defend. And I don't understand why their view. And also, I have been getting news from Israel's point of view about the situation in Gaza and the so-called starvation, which the the news here does not reflect the news in Israel.
Yeah, okay.
At all.
Thank you so much, Ina from Philadelphia. We sorry we had to wrap that up, but we get your point of view there, and that's why we have Mati here. Mati, we want to just check in with you. What are people feeling? What are Israelis feeling right now as this news about a possible famine has sort of rippled, you know, through the world? Your thoughts.
Thanks again for having me on. This is a dark moment for Israelis. We've been at war for a year and 10 months, right? It starts on October 7th, 2023. And although Israel has had some fairly dramatic successes in the regional war, particularly in Lebanon against Hezbollah and in Iran in June, the war in Gaza has turned out to be a long slog that has been costly for Israel. We've lost hundreds of soldiers, including people who I know, and of course, more costly for Palestinians in Gaza. Israel embarks on the war saying it's going to destroy Hamas's military capabilities and get the hostages back. And I think we have to admit, and many people here are admitting, that we have not achieved those goals. So most of the hostages have been released. Some of them were killed. Hamas still has 50 Israelis. We think that 20 of them are alive. We're not quite sure, but it's hard for Israelis to argue that the war has been crowned with success. And at the moment, we're seeing a pretty grim picture of a humanitarian crisis in Gaza. There's argument about how severe it really is, how much is propaganda, how much is real. I did a bit of reporting this on this myself, and my conclusion was that there's real hunger in Gaza. It's being inflated by political actors for various reasons, but the suffering of civilians is real. And that's why you're seeing Gaza flooded right now with humanitarian aid. Israel has made, I think, some grave errors in its handling of the war in general and of this humanitarian issue in particular, and we're paying a price for it right now.
There is a view here among some, mm-hmm. Mati, that Netanyahu has no real interest in ending this war and no real interest in destroying Hamas, and in fact likes the situation where Hamas has some control in Gaza and Fatah has control in the West Bank, and that the Palestinian dreams of nationhood, of statehood, are stifled by this sort of division. Do Israelis see it that way? Do they believe Netanyahu wants to extend this war for political or pragmatic reasons? Or do they believe, you think on the whole, that he is sincere in his wish to exterminate Hamas somehow?
I think that the situation that you're describing was accurate before October 7th. And one of the criticisms, which I agree with, of Netanyahu is that he tried for years to play a game of divide and conquer, and in fact allowed or even encouraged Hamas rule in Gaza as a way of splitting the Palestinian body politic. And that the policy backfired in the most catastrophic way possible on October 7th, when thousands of Hamas fighters came across the border and killed 1,200 Israelis and took 250 people hostage and massacred more than 300 people at a music festival. So there's a lot of criticism of Netanyahu for that. If you look at the situation now, it's quite clear that Netanyahu would love to see Hamas disappear in Gaza. It's also quite clear that Israel's leadership has realized that that is not likely to happen. And the ceasefire talks that are ongoing in Qatar, which many of us expected to yield a ceasefire about 3 weeks ago when Netanyahu was in Washington to meet with President Trump, and didn't in the end yield a ceasefire. But it shows that the Israeli leadership realizes that military force alone is not going to yield success in the war, and that we're going to have to accept some ceasefire for a period of time, which is hopefully going to get most of our hostages out, maybe not all of them. And it's going to leave Hamas in power in some form in Gaza, which is a terrible dilemma for Israelis, because if Hamas is in power, it means that they could attack again. And they quite publicly say that they will. So the Israeli view on Netanyahu, if you look at polls, he has about 40% support. I mean, it's hard to know exactly what the polls are saying. And about 70% of Israelis want the war wrapped up now with a ceasefire, even if it means leaving Hamas in power in Gaza. That's more or less where things stand. Netanyahu has a lot of very fierce critics here. I happen to be one of them, even though I understand many of the dilemmas, which I find to be excruciating, and I'm very happy not to be in his shoes.
Yeah, I want to read this comment from Rachel, who says, most people are getting their news about this in a vacuum. It's hard to differentiate truth from fiction. What I'm finding is that many things can be true at once. Hamas is a terrorist organization that tortured, killed, and raped innocent Israelis and is still torturing the remaining hostages. Netanyahu is a tyrant who is bad for Israel, Gaza, and diaspora Jews. Both Hamas and Netanyahu have a role in the situation in Gaza. And so, you know, Mati, I want to sort of think about next steps because there is an election that could be coming up. So what do you predict here? How can Israelis, if 70% of them, you know, want this war to be over, what are the next steps in sort of communicating that to the leadership and making that a reality in the country?
We have a parliamentary system. So that means that the elections are not set as they are in the United States. They can happen at any time if the government falls. So even if the government loses support for the war, and that has already happened according to polls, it doesn't mean that their parliamentary coalition falls apart. And in a kind of strange and paradoxical way, the less popularity the ruling parties have, the less likely an election is. Because if they're not popular, they're not going to risk an election. So you have a situation where we have a government that is quite unpopular and also quite stable because none of the governing parties want to risk an election that they will lose. So it's very hard to gamble on when exactly an election will happen. Personally, I hope it's as soon as possible. The same leadership that was responsible for the catastrophe of October 7th, and which I think has mishandled this war in many ways, is still running the country. And that seems to me quite intolerable. On the other hand, our opposition is divided. The opposition has been unable to really come up with a compelling candidate or an alternative program. And we're going to have to see all of that happen in the next few months, 6 months, maybe a year. There are betting pools about when the election's actually going to happen.
I want to read this comment from Matt. So similar name to you, Mati. Matt says, October 2023, I felt strongly that Hamas was just asking for trouble, but that both sides are equally to blame in a tit-for-tat conflict. I still think Hamas is evil. They are no friend to the Palestinian people. However, Israel is clearly engaging in genocide. They've said openly they'd like to make Gaza a tourist resort, and they mean to exterminate the living obstacles to that goal. And I read Matt's comment, Mati, because I do believe it reflects some shift among some segment of the American public who 2-3 years ago might have been broadly supportive of Israel, but now find themselves, or maybe on the fence, but now find themselves very much skeptical of American support for Israel moving forward. A, do Israelis care about that? And B, do they believe sort of in the medium term that there's some elasticity to this and that once this version of the conflict ends, it'll go back to the way it was?
Yeah, these are all excellent questions. I just want to point out that the idea of turning Gaza into a tourist resort was actually an idea from your president.
Yes, that's a fair point.
Our leadership. And, you know, there are Israelis who might have liked that idea. I don't think it's anything close to a majority. People here are actually, most of them are quite realistic. I think that we are seeing a shift in public opinion, and I think it's quite dangerous for Israel. And I think that, too, has been mishandled by our leadership, which has been very polarizing, not just in domestic politics, but also in American politics. And we've been unable to maintain that support on both sides of the aisle that Israel traditionally had. Part of that is just the polarization of American politics. Everything is polarized. No one agrees on everything anymore. So if the Republicans are more supportive of Israel, that means that Democrats won't be. That's just 2025 in politics, and that's very unfortunate and very dangerous for Israel. I think we've done a very poor job of making our case. I think this war had to be fought. Israel had no choice. I think it has been prolonged beyond when it should have been halted. But in general, I think the war is a just war. Israel had no option of leaving in place a terrorist group that committed the kind of acts it did on October 7th and said it would do them again. Whether that has been successfully prosecuted, I think we're seeing, you know, for ourselves. I think it hasn't been. A lot of fiery language is used about things, not just Israeli military operations, but, you know, genocide, apartheid. People use very loaded terms to describe the world these days. The world is actually very complicated and things are often very gray. And the closer you are to events, the less easy it becomes to judge them. Israel has been drawn into what the top military brass here is calling the most complicated military problem that ever that Israel has ever experienced. It's a territory where fighters are indistinguishable from civilians, mm-hmm. where they operate from a network of hundreds of miles of tunnels under civilians. Mm-hmm. And in those tunnels, they're holding initially 250 Israeli captives. So it's a military problem from hell. It's certainly not a genocide. It could have been prosecuted better. I have a lot of criticism of the way it's been done. But I think we have to remember that things that look very simple and which are easy to condemn when you are in the United States become much more...
But can I ask you, though,
they're a bit harder to judge when you're close.
Understood. Can I ask you, though, before we wrap up, because we are short on time, what is the case to Americans to continue to play a pivotal role in this? I mean, we have sent more military aid to Israel since 1948 than any other nation on earth by a huge amount. I think it's more than double the next nation. And I think at some point it is incumbent on Israelis to make some sort of case to the Americans to continue to do this when the result seems to be bloodshed, 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 crisis, crisis, crisis. What is our stake in this, Mati, as Americans?
I mean, I feel like it's an excellent question. I'm a journalist and not the Israeli ambassador.
So I understand. I understand.
Make clear that I'm going to try to give you the Israeli position here. And yeah. I'm going to suspend my journalistic faculties for a moment. America has given Israel since the late 1960s military aid. At the moment, it's about $3.5 billion a year. That money is spent almost entirely in the United States. So it's kind of dollars that start with Americans and end with Americans. And I think that that's worth pointing out. America has all kinds of very complicated military commitments all over the world, some of which are extremely expensive. For example, America has 30,000 soldiers protecting South Korea. That is a much more significant military commitment than the commitment to Israel. So I think we have to, and of course there are, you know, troops in Germany, troops in Japan, you know, planes on all kinds of islands in the Pacific. America is all over the place, and it has a long list of very complicated commitments. What Israel would say is that what America gets in return is, you know, sometimes Israel will say it's an unsinkable aircraft carrier in the Middle East. It has a staunch ally in a region where staunch allies are hard to come by, and it has intelligence cooperation, which, according to people who are in the intelligence world, which I'm not, is really something much greater than America has with any other country in terms of what America gets in terms of intel from the Mossad and from Israel's other intelligence arms. So it's not a charity relationship. It's a, you know, tough-nosed geopolitical relationship. It's sometimes ugly. I understand Americans who look at this and say, you know, I need this like a hole in the head. And I think that we do have to make a more intelligent case rather than assuming American support. Mm. I think that, you know, the polls you're citing show us, and yeah. I hope that our leaders are paying attention, we can no longer count automatically on that American support. And we need to explain to people why Israel is a country worth supporting. Yeah. I think it is. Yeah. And I think we've made that case very poorly.
We have to wrap it up, but thank you so much. That is Mati Friedman, a Jerusalem-based columnist for the Free Press. We appreciate your time today on Studio 2.
Thanks again.
And thank you to everybody who called and emailed in. And thanks to our producers, Debbie Bilder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer, Diana Martinez, and Adam Staniszewski engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory from Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. We will talk to you tomorrow.